Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Thank you, Jay. Coming up on today's show, emails leaked by hacktivist site DC Leaks have revealed a private exchange between the former UK Foreign Secretary Jack Straw and former US Secretary of State Colin Powell, with Jack Straw suggesting that the silver lining of the UK's Brexit vote was that it distracted people from the release of the Iraq Chilcot inquiry.
The South African government has barred the anti-gay American pastor Stephen Anderson from entering the country indefinitely, equating Anderson's anti-gay views with hate speech.
The UK Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee has today released a damning report into the invasion of Libya in March 2011. The report states that the invasion was, quote, founded on erroneous assumptions and an incomplete understanding of the evidence.
Only 2 weeks on from the impeachment of Brazil's former president Dilma Rousseff, and the new Temer administration are already making noises about reversing the state monopoly over potentially huge offshore oil reserves.
And with all the speculation over the health of the US presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, we'll be taking a look at some of the most out there claims.
All that and more over the next half hour on this Wednesday edition of World in Focus.
Emails released yesterday by the hacktivist site DC Leaks have revealed a private exchange between the former UK Foreign Secretary Jack Straw and former US Secretary of State Colin Powell from the 4th of July this year, just 19 days before the Brexit vote took place and the day before the release of the Iraq Chilcot inquiry. In the email, Mr. Straw offers to discuss the as yet unreleased details of the report's inquiry, of which he wrote, quote, "I have an idea what's in it."
Arguably the most shocking revelation to emerge from the leaked emails, however, is Mr. Straw's assertion that the upcoming vote on EU membership would divert attention away from the contents of the long-awaited Iraq inquiry. Mr. Straw wrote, quote, "As you will have seen, British politics is in the most extraordinary phase I've ever known. The only silver lining of the Brexit vote is that it will reduce medium-term attention on Chilcot, though it will not stop the day of publication being uncomfortable," end quote.
With me on the line now is the former UK Member of Parliament and vocal opponent of the 2003 Iraq invasion, George Galloway. Thank you for talking to us, Mr. Galloway. Obviously, Jack Straw's comments were made in confidence, but how much do you think they reveal about the true feelings amongst the original architects of the 2003 invasion?
Well, in confidence is a very interesting double entendre. He certainly was full of confidence that Brexit would provide a useful diversion for the people from the devastating Chilcot report, and he was quite confident that he was going to get off scot-free. And so far, at least, he has. It showed a number of things. The hubris of those who committed this great crime, who are not at all ashamed of it, only insistent that they get away with it. And that's, by the way, being repeated all over with the Libya imbroglio in the wake of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee report today. But also it shows the craven attitude of British ministers to, in this case, former United States ministers. He wasn't asking Colin Powell to ring him, but offering to ring Colin Powell. Mm. He wasn't asking Condé Rice to contact him, but asking how he might get in touch with her. The obeisance displayed in these emails to even former United States plenipotentiaries is very revealing indeed, I think. It is a scandal that these people have gotten away with this. The Chilcot report could not have been more damning. The Foreign Affairs Select Committee report into Libya could not be more damning. But the politicians damned are very confident that they themselves will suffer no punishment.
So I mean, would you say then that these emails actually reveal just as much about the US-UK administration's relationship as they do the attitude towards justice through the Chilcot inquiry?
I do. I think on both levels it's revealing, and whoever leaked these emails has done the world a service. It shows that the war criminals have not gone away, that they're still in touch with each other, in league with each other. A kind of Freemasonry of war criminals still exists, and that they are determined to get away with their crime and determined to collaborate with each other in order that none of them should suffer the condign punishment which should be meted out to them.
Josh Galloway, thank you.
Pleasure as always.
And we'll go over now to our correspondent in London, Jim Ensom. Jim, you just heard Josh Galloway there saying that these leaked emails tell perhaps a more about the relationship or the hierarchy, if you like, between the US and UK governments when it comes to foreign policy. But would it be fair perhaps to say that it also shows a level of concern about the legitimacy of the Iraq conflict, the likes of which has never really been publicly conceded by people like Jack Straw?
Very interested to hear what George said there, and also the fact that it's important that these emails have been published, because I think you're right. This was, remember, the first email was 2 days before the publication of the much-awaited Chilcot report into the reasons for going to war in Iraq in 2003. The Chilcot report took 6 years even to begin, and then a further nearly 6 years to result. So it was a huge report. It was a very controversial time. Now, what's important about those emails is that there was no particular worry about it in the US media, but certainly in the UK, it was a very, very controversial issue. Jack Straw was the foreign secretary at the time that Tony Blair went in to the discussions, and they were going through the United Nations to get a resolution to go to war with Iraq. In the run-up to it, there was one of the biggest demonstrations in Britain, we think, well, at least since, well, in certain recent history, against the war. And there was tremendous criticism thereafter of, was it legitimate? Was the Attorney General's advice to Jack Straw and to Tony Blair right? Was it legal? Was it legitimate? And what about the output? You know, once they'd gone in and Saddam Hussein had been toppled, was there any plan for what was going to happen afterwards? The disbandment of the army and the military forces over there, and then the chaos that resulted. So what these emails do suggest is that Straw, quite clearly, 2 days before the report, he admits in the email he hadn't seen it, but he got a fair inkling what it was going to be. And that was certainly going to be some criticism of him and some criticism he expected of Blair. And quite clearly, this email to Powell, dear Colin, Jack, and all of that sort of pally-pally stuff, was clearly a sign, as George says, of some worry about the legitimacy. It is a hint of them.
The emails, of course, are very rare insight into how top-level politicians communicate in private. I wonder, though, have they actually taught us anything that we didn't already know?
I honestly don't think so, to be quite frank with you. I'm one of the few people, sad people in this world, who's actually read the Chilcot report cover to cover. I actually, in my earlier journalistic career, I actually covered the Iraq war actually in Iraq. So I was there. I was embedded with troops, and I was dealing with the USAF and the British military. So there's a lot that we know, and there's a lot that we knew. In fact, when the Chilcot report came out, a lot of people said, well, so what? What did it tell us we didn't already know? The fact of the Chilcot report was that, of course, it's going to be famous for actually pointing the finger at Blair and going as close as possible as to say it was probably illegal and it was probably ill-judged and it was probably wrong to go to war. But I don't think this email volley between Powell and Straw tells us very much more about that. But I think it certainly suggests that there was a worry behind the scenes at US-UK relationships being exposed, and exactly what was going on during the run-up to the Iraq war, and whether or not it was a legitimate war.
Jim Ensom, thank you.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Still to come on the programme, in just a moment we look at the announcement that South African government has barred the anti-gay American pastor Stephen Anderson from entering the country indefinitely.
The UK Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee has today released a damning report into the invasion of Libya in March 2011. The report states that the invasion was, quote, founded on erroneous assumptions and an incomplete understanding of the evidence.
The former president of Argentina, Cristina Fernandez, has been subpoenaed to testify in court next month in connection with an investigation into alleged corruption during her administration, which ended last year.
And with all the speculation over the health of the US presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, we will be taking a look at some of the most out there claims.
The South African government has announced that it's barring the controversial anti-gay American pastor Stephen Anderson from entering the country indefinitely. Mr. Anderson, who runs the Faithful World Baptist Church in Arizona, had planned on visiting South Africa to preach and to recruit people to his church.
The South African Home Affairs Minister, Malusi Gigaba, identified him as a, quote, undesirable person to travel to South Africa. A petition run by LGBTI groups in South Africa reached over 60,000 signatures asking for the pastor to be denied entry to the country based on his homophobic sermon.
Mr. Anderson notoriously released this message following the tragic attacks in Orlando, which saw 50 people killed in a gun attack in a gay nightclub.
The good news is that there's 50 less pedophiles in this world because, you know, these homosexuals are a bunch of disgusting perverts and pedophiles. That's who was a victim here, are a bunch of just disgusting homosexuals at a gay bar, okay?
These comments were highlighted in several of the petitions which were launched in South Africa. Stephen Anderson has also regularly used his sermons to call for the killing of homosexual people.
South Africa has some of the most progressive LGBTI laws in the world. Equal marriage was passed in 2006, change of legal gender has been allowed since 2003, and joint adoption for same-sex couples since 2002. But homophobia is still a problem, especially in rural areas.
Joining us on the line is Lwando Scott of the University of Cape Town. Thank you for joining us, Lwando. Given the progressive laws that South Africa has, had Mr. Anderson been permitted entry to South Africa, do you believe that many people would have attended his talks?
South Africa is a conservative country. We got, you know, as much as we have some really, really progressive legislation, I think that South African society is very slow to kind of realize the progressiveness of the constitution and other kind of legislations. And so I think that he probably there would have been people who have gone to, you know, his church. People love going to church and people, you know, are very religious. And so I think that what the minister has done and, you know, and what the petition from LGBTI advocates and groups and Gay SA Radio, it is really important in kind of making sure that the law, even when the majority of people wouldn't have necessarily been for that, you know, the law kind of takes precedence and it's influential in terms of enabling to protect the rights of minorities.
The Home Affairs Minister said that Anderson's comments were hate crime and he's banned him from entering South Africa indefinitely. This must be a very welcome display of solidarity with the LGBTI community.
Yes, it is. We have been really excited about this. We have really been rejoicing because it's, you know, it's very affirming when the government institutions, you know, get behind citizens, particularly LGBTI citizens. And you know, we've had numerous fights with, you know, the Home Affairs Office and, you know, there are lots of other things that are not going right, particularly for transgendered people and, you know, trying to kind of register themselves with they are transitioning genders, and Home Affairs, you know, has been really, really bad in terms of allowing people to be who they are and to identify the way they want. So this really is a victory. You know, it is something that we are really, really, really glad about. But also, you know, it means that we must continue in terms of pushing for on our leaders and the ministers to do the right thing and to adhere to the legislation of the country.
And just finally, is there any concern across South Africa that this ban could anger homophobic groups to the extent that they become more active and take action?
You know, I don't think so. Of course, one can predict the future. You know, the response to this banning has been really, really positive. And I think because also, you know, currently there is an anti-imperialist kind of moment, if you will, you know, with the movements from the universities and the recent kind of hair politics at the high schools of South Africa. There is a buy-in in terms of generally in South African communities about rejecting kind of outside views on the ways in which South African people, particularly Black people, need to kind of be in the world. And so I think that this decision by the minister and by Home Affairs kind of is in line with that ethos. It's in line with this, you know, let's not let kind of outside powers, if you want, kind of dictate the ways in which we want to go about dealing with internal issues or influencing, particularly negatively, as with this pastor, some of the things that are going on in the country. And I mean, some of the people might not necessarily agree with, quote unquote, you know, the gay lifestyle, but I think the anti-imperialistic ethos is much more bigger than that.
Well, Lwando Scott, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Yes, thank you very much.
The situation in Tripoli is clearly very fluid and there is absolutely no room for complacency. Our task now is to do all we can to support the will of the Libyan people, which is for an effective transition to a free, democratic and inclusive Libya.
The then UK Prime Minister David Cameron speaking at Downing Street in 2011 during the invasion of Libya. The UK Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee has today released a damning report into the invasion of Libya in March 2011, when the United Kingdom and France, with support of the United States, led an intervention in Libya to protect civilians from attacks by forces loyal to Colonel Gaddafi. The report states, quote, UK strategy in Libya was founded on erroneous assumptions and an incomplete understanding of the evidence.
Many elements of the report echo Sir John Chilcot's inquiry into the 2003 invasion of Iraq, led by the then Prime Minister Tony Blair. Today's report claims that the government was not informed by accurate intelligence and highlights a lack of strategy to support post-Gaddafi Libya, saying, quote, the result was political and economic collapse into militia and intertribal warfare, humanitarian and migrant crises, widespread human rights violations, the spread of Gaddafi regime weapons across the region and the growth of ISIL in North Africa, end quote.
Joining us on the line is Professor Paul Rogers, Professor of Peace Studies at the University of Bradford. Professor Rogers, thank you for joining us. The report states that the UK government did not explore political alternatives and instead focused exclusively on military intervention. Might one argue that this sole focus on military intervention is just the modus operandi of Western nations these days?
It could well be, but one could also say that of Russia as far as Syria is concerned. But if you go back to Libya in particular, the original motivation apparently was to prevent a massacre of civilians in Benghazi. It was actually very much instigated by the French, with the British following very closely behind. The Americans were quite significant in the early stages, providing intelligence and other things, but it became essentially a Franco-British operation later on, albeit under the guise of being a NATO operation, in pursuit of rather vague resolutions by the United Nations. But the problem was, and I think this is the key thing, is that what would have been a limited intervention to protect civilians developed into, in fact, what one analyst calls an opportunist policy of regime change. In other words, the decision was taken to go for full regime change. Quite extraordinary, given that only a week or two before this intervention started, you had French and Italian arms companies working closely with the Gaddafi government in terms of upgrading its own army and air force. So one would get a little bit cynical about this in some ways, but it's certainly true to say that once the whole thing had evolved into a more serious intervention, both the French and the British and some other allied governments really pushed it through until the regime fell, with virtually no planning for what might happen afterwards. It was almost sort of, let's get on with this, we know how to do this, we will not really take it through in terms of what happens afterwards. And that is where the problems really developed on a huge level.
One of the criticisms of the report is that the government didn't have complete intelligence and that it had an insufficient institutional insight. Do you think that the government fails to pay respect to the importance of having solid intelligence in these kinds of conflicts?
I think it almost rushed into it. I mean, the government that was really pushing it very hard was France under Sarkozy. There's no doubt about that. But the British followed pretty willingly because, in a sense, it showed the French and the British as sort of major serious players, but serious players in what was a military operation, not something more broadly. And I think almost from the start, the military overshadowed the political. What is extraordinary is the extent to which this happened only, in 2011, when we'd already had the major problems in Afghanistan and, of course, Iraq. And one had hoped that people might have learned lessons from that, but obviously not. But you could say the claim about what is happening in Syria and Iraq at the present time, where you have multiple Western interventions involving many states.
Do you think that perhaps this is as another report damning the actions of the government and the insufficient intelligence, they might pay more heed in future?
You would hope so. I mean, we've had Chilcot, we've had this. Now, this isn't with the depth of Chilcot, but certainly for a House of Commons Select Committee report, it's a lot more detailed and involved much more work and the taking of far more witness statements than is usual. So consequently, it will basically stand in pretty good stead. I would love to think that, in a sense, it will be the kind of report added to others which does persuade governments to be very, very cautious about military intervention. There's very little sign of that, and I have to say that applies right across the board from the United States, Britain, France, many others, and, of course, including Russia too.
And do you think that this could evolve into a Chilcot-style inquiry?
No, I think it will probably end here. It might have been different if David Cameron hadn't resigned a couple of days ago. But I think it will probably end here, although hopefully, maybe it's a wishful thinking, hopefully lessons might be learnt this time round.
One of the other findings of the report was regards the responsibility of the government now post the intervention. It says that it has a particular responsibility to help support a Libyan economic and political reconstruction, and the responsibility in relation to refugees. Of course, the refugee crisis has been exasperated by the collapse of the Libyan state. Do you think that Theresa May's government are likely to take any of these recommendations on board?
Not very much, no, bluntly. I don't think the British government wants to get involved further. It's absolutely correct to say that the flush of refugees and many economic migrants from sub-Saharan Africa through Libya has been made hugely easier by the almost coming apart of the country and the entry of a whole range of criminal elements which aid the movement of people. It's certainly clear that what happened in Libya and the Western intervention has made the current problem of migration very much worse. But I can't see any immediate response from the British government. You don't sense that they want to get involved anymore. So I think they will just hope that this will more or less blow over, primarily because there has been a change of leadership. You will get some fairly fine words. I don't expect very much action. I wish it was different.
Well, Professor Rogers, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
The former president of Argentina, Cristina Fernandez, has been subpoenaed to testify in court next month in connection with an investigation into alleged corruption during her administration, which ended last year. Ms. Fernandez and her late predecessor and husband, Néstor Kirchner, have faced accusations of corruption for some years now, accusations she vehemently denies, arguing that they comprise little more than a vindictive crusade by her successor, President Mauricio Macri. The order released by the Official Judicial Information Centre stated that, quote, the reported crimes started in late 2003 and were related to public works contracts that the state awarded to a small group of businesses without following regulations.
Cristina Fernandez's former public works secretary, José López, has also been subpoenaed. López stunned his fellow Argentines earlier this year when he was caught attempting to stash holdalls containing millions of dollars of cash in a Buenos Aires convent. The incident sparked a considerable amount of intrigue, indeed, continues to. Though Fernandez has been close to López, she has denied any connection to the case, saying, quote, somebody gave Mr. López the money he held in his possession, and it wasn't me. Cristina López is due to testify in court on the 20th of October.
It's barely 2 weeks since the Brazilian Senate voted to impeach President Dilma Rousseff in a move denounced by her supporters as a parliamentary coup. The incoming administration of Michel Temer has been accused of many ulterior motives in pushing for Rousseff's removal, but most prevalent amongst those accusations is a shift towards a more conservative, more corporate and even US-friendly position. Those suspicions certainly gained traction with the early announcements of privatisation proposals as well as cuts to health and education funding, even as Temer took office as interim leader. But now it looks as though one of Brazil's major state-owned assets could be on the verge of privatisation, that being Brazil's offshore pre-salt assets.
For those unfamiliar with such terminology, pre-salt refers to largely untapped oil fields situated beneath a salt layer formed around 500 million years ago. Such reserves are particularly prevalent off the coasts of Africa and Brazil and are thought to represent a significant fraction of untapped global oil resources. Currently, the state-owned oil company Petrobras is guaranteed a monopoly over exploitation of such reserves, but the incoming Michel Temer administration has long been eyeing the potential to reverse that legislation. Indeed, José Serra, the new foreign minister, gave assurances to that effect back in 2009 when speaking to foreign oil companies, including Chevron.
Joining me on the line now from Leiden in the Netherlands is Professor of Brazilian Studies at Leiden University, Dr. Edmond Aman. Thank you for speaking with us, Dr. Aman. Now, let's be honest, José Serra has been making noises towards the likes of Chevron for some years that the previous framework favouring the state could be reversed in favour of foreign private oil multinationals. Given that, should these latest developments surprise anyone?
I don't think so. Clearly, we've just had a change at the top in Brazil. President Temer, who was the interim president, has now been confirmed in post following the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff. And it's undoubtedly the case that the new administration is more committed to a market-friendly approach than its predecessor. So what we're seeing in the oil sector is replicated in other sectors. For example, announcements have been made regarding the privatization of three airports and also the opening up of highway concessions to private sector involvement. So this is very much part of, I think, an accelerated market liberalization process under this government. Of course, in the past, let's not forget, parts of the Brazilian oil sector have been opened up to foreign participation. In the 1990s, for example, parts of the offshore exploration sector were opened up. But the pre-salt deposits had been subject to a special regime, which meant that national oil companies, specifically Petrobras, had a 30% guaranteed minimum stake. Therefore, you know, there were limits placed on foreign involvement. So this is, in a sense, what we're seeing here. This proposal is to open up still further an area which was already, to some quite considerable extent, open to foreign participation.
As you said there, obviously the new Temer administration is very keen on moving things in the direction of privatization and corporate influence. But his opponents have argued that that was very much the motivation behind the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff. Do you think that maybe the speed at which this is happening, I mean, we're only 2 weeks on from the impeachment, do you think that gives credence to the argument that actually, rather than corruption necessarily, the motivation behind this change at the top was more of a move towards privatisation?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's no question about it that the new administration is more committed to market reform. But there were serious issues regarding the competence of the Rousseff administration. And it's also the case, of course, that economic performance under that administration was very poor. And, of course, there were significant corruption scandals, admittedly not just affecting the party of President Rousseff, but other parties as well. So I think, you know, in looking for, you know, motives underlying the impeachment, there are a lot of factors at work. I mean, clearly many people were resentful of the statist approach of the Rousseff administration and were very happy to see her go. But on the other hand, there are many other motives at play here, and this is in the mix for sure. But it's not really the key cause, at least not in my view.
Well, Professor Edmond Aman, thank you very much for talking to us.
Okay, thanks so much.
And finally, Hillary Clinton has been in the news a lot this week. Obviously, she's running for US president, but she's been in the news for not so positive reasons this week. Following her health scare at the 9/11 memorial in New York on Sunday, speculation about the Democratic nominee's health has run wild. She has, of course, said that her poor health was nothing more than a bout of pneumonia, but that hasn't stopped people from diagnosing her with, well, all sorts of things.
Yes, the National Enquirer, that bastion of political insight, suggested that Hillary has suffered multiple strokes. Various other sources have then said that she has been hiding a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. Now, those two things don't sound completely ridiculous for a 68-year-old woman working in a high-stress environment. But there is more, and it does get a little bit more crazy. Alex Jones's InfoWars, which, just for background, they also believe that chemtrails are being used by governments to control the population, or something like that, reckons that she has Parkinson's, and a supposed medical professor come vlogger reckons that she has got just 1 year to live.
Those examples are, of course, Jack Pretty Tame. She's also been accused of having a body double, having to wear adult nappies, but best of all, my absolute favourite, that all of these are side effects of her affair with an alien lover.
An alien lover?
Yeah, somebody actually said that she's been having an affair with an alien.
I think we've crossed over the line from, like, serious news coverage here.
I think
at
a
some
lot
point.
Of the stories going on about Hillary Clinton's health
didn't
across
someone,
the line.
Didn't someone say that Donald Trump was actually an alien?
I think someone did.
But then we said that he had a cat instead of hair yesterday, so...
We did. On that note, that is all we have time for in this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, it's the Tom Hartman Show in Washington, D.C. Till tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster.
And from me, Carolyn Scott.
Goodbye.